Okay, I think we are ready to begin. So I want to thank everyone for being here. My name is Peter Hansen, and I was asked to introduce our panelists today. And hope everyone's in the right place. This is a workshop or a panel discussion about how we teach all subjects in the poetic stage or the rhetoric stage, the high school years. Hey. And how do we do that so that we train great orators, great speakers? I want to introduce a couple of our panelists. Start here with James Kane. James and his wife, Christy, they have three kids. He received a Bachelor of Arts in English from Emmanuel College and a Master of Arts in English from the University of Georgia. He is currently a graduate student at Covenant College, and he has been a headmaster of Dominion Classical Christian Academy in Lawrenceville, Georgia, since 2007. Did I get that right? All right, fantastic. Well, I also learned that James Kane is famous for being the only man in history to turn in his master's thesis with the words blah, blah, blah in them. So I think that deserves a round of applause. Man, a history maker right here. Okay. Peter Alvarez, sitting to James's left here, holds an undergraduate degree in philosophy. Awesome. My fellow philosopher. And a graduate degree in philosophy of religion from Boston University, both conferred with academic honors. He completed postgraduate research in classical languages and literature at Boston Theological Institute before beginning his doctoral research in philosophy of mind and cognitive neuropsychology under Dr. Nancy Murphy and Dr. Warren Brown. Peter Alvarez maintained professional membership with APA, the American Philosophical Association, the American Academy of Religion, and the Society for Phenomenology and Existential Philosophy, among others. In addition to participating in research colloquiums, Alvarez has held leadership positions in numerous humanities departments, including Gordon College, Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary, Fuller Theological Seminary, Southern New Hampshire, etc. Currently, Alvarez teaches Socratics, Rhetoric, and Senior Thesis courses at Regents School of Austin, my former haunt. So, I also learned that Peter Alvarez is quite the gifted dog whisperer. He has taught his dog Pumpkin, a chocolate lab. I don't know why Pumpkin and chocolate lab go together, but okay, right. He has taught his dog Pumpkin sign language. I think that deserves a round of applause. So in those studies of neuroscience and things like this, the cognitive, right, yes, you've been applying them to animal intelligences. Very good. I also have the privilege of introducing Mr. Ralph Janikowski. I've worked with Ralph back when I was teaching at Rockbridge and studying at St. John's College, and I was teaching Ralph's daughter literature, and so I got to know Ralph, and he was actually in the military at the time, still there, and so I'll read some of his biography here. Ralph is the upper school principal at Rockbridge Academy. He oversees grades 7 through 12, and he is a distinguished graduate of both the United States Naval Academy and the National War College. He, during his 28-year career in the U.S. Navy, he served as chief engineer of the nuclear cruiser USS Virginia, commissioning executive officer of the cruiser USS Vicksburg, commanding officer of the destroyer USS Hewitt in Yokosuka, Japan, and commanding officer of the cruiser USS Princeton during Operation Iraqi Freedom. His shore tours included serving as the director of classroom instruction at the nuclear prototype in Idaho Falls, Idaho, and the Navy chair and professor of military strategy at National Defense University. He is an elder at the Reformed Presbyterian Church of Bowie, PCA Church, and previously served 2 years as an elected board member of Rockbridge Academy. His wife, Linda, teaches upper school math at Rockbridge Academy, and they have two daughters, Leslie, a graduate of the University of Virginia, and Kristen, who is currently in 10th grade. So, Ralph's claim to fame, of course, is that he was the chief engineer of a nuclear-equipped cruiser. That deserves a round of applause. All right, so without further ado, I'm going to turn things over to James Cain, who will open us up with his opening statement.
Thank you, Peter. I feel like I need to qualify my blah, blah, blah statement and say that I submitted the wrong copy to my committee, and they were very generous, very understanding, and thankfully I remembered what was supposed to go where blah, blah, blah was in the copy. So thank you for foregoing one of the greater orators that we know to come to our session to talk about how to create or how to train great orators. We were joking beforehand that we might have six people going opposite George Grant. So, but thank you for being here. And we've got a good natural progression, I think, because we're moving a little bit from general to specific. And I, like some of you perhaps, am serving at a school that's young, and we are growing by year by adding a grade. So we'll add eighth grade next year and are beginning to think about the very question that we're dealing with in this panel. So I'm going to talk in general terms about the things that we have discussed, the things that are occupying our mind as we consider how will we do this, how will we accomplish this, and then I'll leave it to my colleagues here to talk about some of the specifics about how that happens. It's a question that we ask often in our circles. Where have all the great orators gone? When you look at lists of great speeches, most of them have not happened in the last 25 years. There are a few that make the list, but not many. And this year I had the good fortune, the blessing, to come across a post by Elizabeth Scalia on the blog of First Things magazine. And she asked that very question, is great oratory over and done? And in examining particularly political speech over the last few years, she asks this question: Where have they gone? Why is this stopped? And one of the things she said stood out to me, and in fact, the whole article served as a pretty good framework for what I'd like to say. Great oratory, she says, requires both a love of ideas and the words that bring them forth and make them seem not just plausible but noble. Not just noble, but unstoppable. So I want to talk about that for a second. First of all, the foundations of what we do, how we train great orators, is to first of all cultivate a love for ideas. Now, that word cultivation, I'm choosing that very carefully. If any of you are gardeners in here, you know that you enter every year with a great sense of hope and cultivation. You prepare the ground, you give it all you can, but in the end, the Apostle Paul got it right. God gives the increase. We sow, we water, but ultimately we don't control the outcome of the things that we plant. The same thing is true for our students, our mission statements, and even this idea of cultivating a love for ideas. We plant as much as we can. We prepare the soil. We try and cultivate a love for ideas. Now, how do we do that? I want to get to that in just a second. Cultivating a love for words, the same deal applies here. We want to prepare them to love words, love what words can accomplish, love what they can convey, love even the sound of words as they can get across to listeners. This letter C under two foundations here, infusing both with nobility. This is a challenge, particularly in our day, where speech, oratory, has primarily become about noise. Who speaks loudest? Who speaks with the most fervor? No matter what they actually say. No matter what they're actually defending. And we have to take care that our students come to understand that ideas and words have objective worth, objective standards. And there are some words which are beautiful, which are noble. There are some ideas which are beautiful, which are noble. There are some ideas and words which are not. And that's an important distinction for our students to begin to be able to make. For them to be able to make that distinction, we have to be able to make that distinction. And part of what we have to do is learn to sift the things that we hear. Read widely and absorb lots of examples of the ideas and words to discern what is noble and what is ignoble. The application I've given in this section is listening, and that's what I'm getting at here. Listening to lots of speech, lots of talks, and reading lots of speech, lots of talks, will help us to begin to parse those ideas and words so that we're able to convey it in a meaningful way to our students. That doesn't mean we have to flip on CNN or Fox News every time the president gives a speech. Political speech is just one segment of oratory. Now, granted, it's the most well-televised aspect of oratory now, but we can look and find good examples of that. Mentioned earlier today, the speeches that are given at commencements often run the gamut of ideas and words and give us lots of opportunities to see examples of speech off the beaten path. They don't often make headlines as the You Are Not Special commencement speech did, but they are out there. And the nice thing about them is they're often filmed, so you can find them on YouTube or Vimeo and see examples of people delivering speeches well and poorly, nobly and ignobly. So listening to those things and teaching your students how to listen is an important application for us. The second thing I want to mention is knowledge. And actually, the last three things, knowledge, skills, and ideas, are a pretty useful framework for us to think about as we teach. Teaching content, teaching capabilities, teaching concepts to our students. First, we have to be able to encounter knowledge about speeches. That's what it means when we look for examples of great speech in all areas. Learn to identify the great orators in your subject area. That's more difficult depending on what your subject area is. If you teach political science, if you teach history, you won't have much trouble. If you teach science or math, it may be a little more difficult. But you can find examples, and you should find examples. And the second thing I mentioned is analysis. Now, I don't mean purely a scientific analysis. I really mean an immersion in the language and the ideas of what these great speeches convey. Real immersion and absorption of what they're doing so that you're able to internalize the ideas, internalize the words, and convey them meaningfully to your students. And that's why I say that the application there is translation. I don't mean translating from one language to another, but I do mean looking at examples of great speech and seeing what can be translated to another subject, another idea, another group of words. How can you take a great example such as Pericles' funeral oration, and this eulogy? How can the ideas, the words, the structure help to convey something entirely different? Learning to translate a speech from one subject to another is a valuable skill, and that takes me to the next section there: the skills we're trying to cultivate in our students. Structure, understanding the structure of speeches is an important skill. It's not innate to us. That's part of what immersion will bring about for us, but we have to be able to see the structure in a speech. I was listening this morning to the runner-up for the Chrysostom Award, listening to that carefully structured argument and being able to see here's where he's dealing with objections. Now, he gives us good markers for that. You don't always get good markers in speech, but being able to find them and see them in the structure is important. The second thing is imagery. This is more difficult today than ever because, as Elizabeth Scalia notes, what's missing from our current crop of gushers and gas bags, I quote her, is the ability to define poetry in their texts or even to purposely include it. There is an absence of love for imagery and facility with imagery in current speech of all kinds, but particularly of the kinds that we hear. So we're talking about the poetic stage, and we should approach it not just in the way that Sayers uses poetry, but also in the sense that language must have poetry. She gives the example in the article of Winston Churchill and wondering if he would have inspired the British people quite so much if he hadn't used that powerful passage: "We shall fight them on the beaches, we shall fight on the landing grounds, we shall fight in the fields and in the streets, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender." That powerful imagery coupled with great structure, great words, and my third line there, certitude. this conviction that he had in the darkest hour of Britain's time in the war, to be able to convey with certitude that there was hope, that there was worth fighting for. Now, she gives the definition of oratory. Great oratory is fine structure plus powerful imagery delivered in a voice full of certitude. You and I know, and Ralph and I were talking beforehand about the lack of ethical foundation in our country, that there's not a word about ethics there. You can deliver a finely structured, powerfully populated with powerful imagery and delivered in a voice full of certitude, a speech that is heinous, that encourages sin. That's not what we want to cultivate. So we dare not teach our students to speak with certitude unless we give them the foundation, the ethical foundation, the love for Jesus Christ and his kingdom that will enable them to engage with the world at the place where we now find ourselves. Okay? And the application there is interpretation. So as they're reading these speeches, as you're immersing yourself in these speeches, it's crucial, essential to be able to interpret the ethical foundation behind what they're saying, to really understand not just the how it's clothed, the structure and imagery, but also to understand how it what's underneath the skeleton of the speech. Now that brings us to ideas. A word fitly spoken, the scripture said, is like apples of gold, right? This is crucial. There's an economy of language in poetry and in great speech that we need to capture and convey to our students. We need to be able to understand what that means, and to understand, too, that great speech without great ideas isn't great speech. They need to be able to engage with ideas on that level. And to be able to see, too, that there's an integrative goal for speech that is ignored sometimes. A great speech delivered for a political purpose can bring lots of things to bear. There can be a great sense of integration. The same thing is true for someone who is trying to defend or attack an ethical transgression in our culture. Someone delivering a speech in defense of abortion, they've chosen a great idea, but they've chosen to approach it from a poor ethical foundation, right? So we want to be for our students to be able to approach those ideas from the right standpoint, and also to bring so much to bear, not just a reflexive kind of defense of life, but a defense of life from a biological standpoint, from an anthropological standpoint, from a philosophical standpoint, from a theological standpoint, from a biblical standpoint. Be able to bring all those things together to integrate their ideas into great speech. And the application I've given there is mimesis, that imitation. What I mean here is that we have got to become great orators as well. If we hope to cultivate great orators in our schools, we've got to approach the task we have to teach them well with a seriousness. That means we prepare ourselves. We prepare the way that we talk to them. As a head of school, I get lots of opportunities to speak to the entire student body. You may not all have that opportunity. You have your class. So, and preparing every day to deliver a great oration isn't realistic, is it? Your time is compressed. You're challenged with lesson planning and grading, and dealing with parents is compressed and requires a lot of attention anyway. But if you approach your work with this idea, this basic idea of what do I love, what ideas am I in love with in my subject right now, what that I'm trying to convey, what words can I use to convey these ideas, and do I love them? Do I get a great sense of how I can convey them? And then the last thing is infusing it with nobility. Loving your subject means recognizing the places where your subject is noble, the ideas that are noble in your subject. And if you do that, your students will begin to catch that sense and be able to convey their thoughts in a more meaningful way as well. Thank you.
I forgot to mention, if I could just insert Good afternoon. When I first received the invitation to join the panel and discuss what it means to teach all subjects in the poetic stage, to train great orators, I remember thinking, oh my goodness, that's a huge task, right? We have an hour, there are three panelists, we want to leave about half the time for Q&A, so I have 10 minutes, what am I going to say? And so I quickly threw together a logical trajectory that I thought would serve as a template to help guide our thoughts to think a little bit about some of my interests in public speaking and the philosophical dimension of what it means to be engaged in the exigence that we cultivate in speech acts. And so in front of you on page 98, if you're looking in your handbook, you see that I intended to begin with a brief analysis of reference theory and semantic holism and speech act theory so that I could talk a little bit about what the word meaning means, right? To talk about how words and sentences and paragraphs and how language hooks on to the world so that I could talk a little bit about why helping students to think in particular patterns helps them to speak in patterns that are meaningful and provocative and ethically robust, etc. I think I'm going to move away from that initial trajectory because I think the emphasis here in this setting may be more helpful for us to talk about the practical components. If we have time later during the Q&A session, if you'd like to ask about that, I'd be happy to discuss those concepts. But as a student or as a teacher at Regents, before I go into a class regularly, I'll think of something my father-in-law said to me. My father-in-law is a pastor in New Jersey. And once in a conversation over dinner, he said, you know, Peter, I think there's a difference between having something to say and just wanting to be heard. And I think for me, that resonated because I think as a teacher of rhetoric and as somebody who's interested in philosophy of language, I'm always tempted to focus on issues of style and issues of content, right? In the humanities in particular, are you a master at your subject, right? And with style, the stuff of rhetorical theory and stylistic figures and how these things come together so that words, when written and spoken in a certain way, are elegant and beautiful. But I think what my father-in-law had in mind, sort of in a very his own underhanded but careful way, was to remind me of the importance of intention. And so I want to talk a little bit about the fact that Regents, I think, in particular, does a great job of coupling style, content, with the stuff of intention. So not only teaching students how to understand rhetorical theory and what stylistic figures look like, and not only being able to be masters of the areas that they want to do research in and then ultimately speak on, but how to do those things with an eye towards the true, the good, and the beautiful. Why is this important? It's important because I think speech is intrinsically morally laden, right? To be involved in rhetoric, as Aristotle said, rhetoric is the art or the faculty of discovering all the available means of persuasion in any given situation whatsoever. And I respect Aristotle, but I think that Quintilian probably had it more right when he defines rhetoric as good persons or good men speaking well. And so for me, I would implore us, or my sort of clarion call is to encourage us as instructors to think beyond teaching students the sort of gestures and movements and the stuff of memory and delivery and such, are we teaching students to filter their ideas through a conceptual framework that helps them to understand the philosophical and moral implications of what's involved when they are speaking? Again, why is this important? Because if we teach students the stuff of style and content, but we fail to teach them to process these concepts in appropriate moral categories, we wind up with the stuff of sophistry, right? Which is something that I think is a characterization of our culture, and it's unfortunate. But it's very easy for us to train teachers or to train students to think and to speak well, but to speak without an eye towards the moral significance of their words. So what does this look like in the classroom? As a humanities instructor, we have classes that are organized around what we call Harkness tables, right? So 9, 11, 13 of us sit around and we have conversations about great books and great texts. In particular, in rhetoric and Socratics and senior thesis, we have opportunities to debate. Students can participate in mock trial. In Socratics, we teach students how to think critically, how to ask morally principled questions about texts. And in senior thesis, we spend a decent amount of time thinking about the moral implications of a particular argument. Within senior thesis, which happens to be something that I spent a lot of time this past year teaching and working on, we have our students begin in the beginning of the year, after they've studied in a sort of cursory way, going back over the stylistic figures and the rhetorical theory. We go back and the students select a topic, and then they write this précis assignment, right? This sort of historical overview of one particular issue so that they can be masters of their content. 10 pages, parenthetical citation, basic MLA sorts of stuff. And after they feel sufficiently comfortable with that material, we ask them to write an antithesis speech. So they present a speech of about 10 to 15 minutes in length, where they're allowed to consult their notes, but they're arguing for a position that runs antithetical to their own. After that, we begin to give them little assignments where they do their exordium and narratio and partitio, their confirmatio, refutatio, and paratio, these different speech parts, and they submit these pieces individually, and then at the end, they resubmit them as sort of an integrated whole where we try to weave out any dissonances in their speech and try to create a more unified train of thought. But we do all of this having already spent time thinking of the philosophical implications of their work. So I've already invested a good amount of time asking them, what would the deontological, the pragmatic, the virtue, the utilitarian, if somebody were to represent a different world philosophical matrix, how would they push back against your idea? And I think that's really important. It's really important because by encouraging people to think about the philosophical ramifications of their ideas, we alter the way that they think, right? And as a result of altering the way that they think, we alter their actions, their decisions, which in turn may have implications for their habits and then have implications for their character as well. And I don't want to digress too much. I'm happy to talk more about that at another time. But I just want to close with reiterating the fact that I think teaching students to speak well is more than the stuff of teaching students how to use gesture and how to use movement and how to memorize and sort of enunciate and pronounce words well. It's the stuff of taking those ideas and recapitulating them through a biblical and a Christian framework. So, thank you.
Peter and James have done a great job of providing a foundation about how to think about rhetoric and how to think about speaking. Let me go into some of the specifics to kind of finish this up. Talked about my 28 years in the Navy. What I saw when I was on my ship were young men and women who would show up, very smart, very capable, but without an ethical foundation, and largely unsuccessful in their 19 or 20 years of life. How is our education system producing such unsuccessful, talented young men and women? And so my big role as a captain, if I wanted to repair the ruins, was to first give them an ethical foundation, which is what classical Christian education is all about. And then secondly, to teach them that they could be successful. And I think when Peter talked about a good man speaking well as the heart of rhetoric, the good man, that ethical man, speaking well, being successful, that much of being a good rhetor, a good speaker, is leadership. We're training our young men and women how to be leaders. It is hard to get up in front of an audience and to speak well, and that's what we want these high school students to do. And so you have to teach them how to deal with stress. And I say, I would argue that that's fundamentally important to us as Christians because we're commanded to do this. We're commanded to give a defense of the hope that's within us whenever we're called upon. And so we are giving them the tools to pursue their Christian faith, the tools of learning beyond high school. They should desire to talk about their faith. And so that's why I think this has real relevance and real importance to us. And if you start in the PERT stage, the rhetoric stage, it's too late, the POEC stage. You have got to be building this into your curriculum at the grammar stage, the dialectic stage, and the rhetoric stage, such that children become confident standing in front and reciting poetry, reciting their scripture verses, leading the class in the chant, and that every day they know that in some way they're going to be placed on display. They get comfortable with the stress of standing in front of a group of people. And so that's built into the curriculum. And the thesis doesn't start as a senior. It really starts with us at Rockbridge in seventh grade, where we have a science project. And they repeat the great science projects of the past. But then they have to go and present that first to their teacher and their classmates, and then we have to go present it to the grammar school. We take those historical projects, science projects, and then we go to that grade that has studied that part of history and let the seventh graders present to the sixth graders, the fifth graders, the fourth graders, the third graders, the great experiments of history. You want a seventh grader to feel like a dialectic student? Have them teach grammar school kids. All right? They immediately feel different, act different, and develop confidence in their abilities. In eighth grade, we have them study Islam, and we want them to be able to speak eloquently on the differences between Christianity and Islam. And they need to come to the conclusion that the fundamental difference is the person and work of Jesus Christ. And to get an eighth grader to stand up and talk about their faith and why it's important to them is a huge accomplishment. And so in eighth grade, we want them to discuss Islam, Christianity, and draw a conclusion. In ninth grade, we want them to study World War II as part of their European history. How do you study World War II at the end of a school year? It's impossible. At National Defense University, where I taught, I take a full course to talk about one theater in World War II. And so the point is, you don't have to cover all of World War II to teach World War II. Pick some high points. What would you brief the president on this week? And then have the students teach each other. Spend 2 weeks where you have the high points assigned to the various students. Let them develop the speeches and let them tell the story of history. Telling a good story helps students get over the hump of how to be good orators. And history is a wonderful story when told well. In 10th grade, we want them to start doing research. And so we teach them the skills of research. We take them to a community college library and have the college librarian talk to them about how to use databases. And then we have them learn about science and do an ethical presentation on something like ANWR. Or ethanol, and they have to take a position and defend it. And what they're not used to is having somebody take the opposite position and come up with good arguments that oppose them. And so now we're building in stasis. The students need to understand there's an opposite side to every answer, and we want them to see that. So now we have classical Christian students on both sides of the ethanol equation, on both sides of whether we should drill in ANWR or not. And they debate one another. And in the process, we have to teach them how to be humble and joyful. Why is this important? You're going to want your kids to be able to evaluate good speaking. So you're going to develop some criteria that you need all your teachers to use. And that criteria needs to start in the grammar with, are they doing hand gestures? Under the spreading chestnut tree, the village smithy stands. The smith, the mighty man, is he with large and sinewy. That's probably a great grammar school presentation. When it gets up into the rhetoric, that same beautiful Longfellow poem can be used much more eloquently with different gestures to accomplish a very powerful presentation. And so how do you start working hand gestures in? How do you work in eye contact? How do you work in vocal inflections that all your teachers are grading? You have to have grade sheets. And you have to have all the teachers use them. And they progress. They get more sophisticated in the grammar school to the dialectic, to the rhetoric. Such in the rhetoric, you're worried about eye contact, diction, tone, pace, gestures. And so just grading the rhetoric can be a difficult job. So we'll have the students help in the grading. You people over here, you're going to grade the rhetoric. You people over here are going to grade content. I'm going to have each one of you ask a question, such that whenever a speech is given in class, all the students have a responsibility to participate, either in evaluating the rhetoric or evaluating the content and asking questions afterward, forcing that student to defend their ideas. So cross-examinations become very important to defending ideas, to being confident behind a podium. We'll have a chance to do this with you all in a few moments here. And then there are some tools that can help you. We have three contests every year we have our students participate in, and I would encourage you, I'll tell you what three we use, but use whatever works with your curriculum. It's got to fit within your curriculum. We use the VFW. Every year we have a Veterans Day celebration. We want our kids to love and appreciate American history. And so we do a Veterans Day celebration. We invite a veteran to come in and speak to our students. And in preparation for that, we have our high school students, both the middle school and the high school, participate in the VFW essay, Patriot's Pen, or Voice of Democracy contest. And they typically do very well, and oh, by the way, they earn money when they do very well, and so they've learned to become very excited about doing this. And then at our Veterans Day celebration, we pick the two best to present to the students. The Rotary Club has an annual speech competition. I would encourage you in your communities, contact the Rotary and find out about the speech competition. 5 to 7 minute speech on the four criteria that the Rotary uses to evaluate, is it good, is it true, is it beneficial to all concerned, and does it promote goodwill? Well, those are classic Christian sort of values. Our kids should be eager to take an issue and apply those values to it in a persuasive manner. So it fits within the context, particularly of our rhetoric curriculum. And then we use the ACCS speech competition every year as the capstone event for our thesis students. And we take the best one and we forward that. As you saw Daniel's this morning, he was our best ACCS speech, our best thesis presentation this year. And so these things fit in, but it gives the students an opportunity to memorize and to work on their delivery. And so can you do too much public speaking? Absolutely. You've got to, across all these different subjects, pick and choose your opportunities such that the students can really invest in them and do well. That your teachers really grade them, both on the rhetoric and the content using those grade sheets, and give them feedback. I find that a lot of my teachers like to film their speeches such that they can ask good cross-ex questions and then go re-listen to the speech and look at the rhetoric more carefully on their own. That's a tool that can be used. We have the students participate. And we grade our students on their ability to listen to a speech and critique the speech and ask good questions. If we've done a week of speeches, because typically if you're going to do a speech, 10 to 15 minutes, as Peter talked about, and then ask some questions, you do two or three speeches at most a day. And so to get through a class takes a full week. How do the students stay engaged? They stay engaged because you grade their ability to ask questions to listen to the speeches, process it, and come up with good questions. And so everyone's involved in the process, and everyone learns together. We need to appreciate that the oratory is a perishable skill, and the culture is deforming what we teach. The culture is deforming what we teach. Listen to two 10th graders talk in the back of your car, and you will hear the word like 10 times a minute. It's well like, you know, like. And it's a constant stream with no subjects, no periods, and like is a transition that works with any phrase. How do you take that now and develop good orators? You have to give them practice, and good feedback. And finally, all this isn't worthwhile unless we're doing it with a biblical worldview. And I think this is where we can have a huge impact on our students by causing them to think about, what does Scripture say about this topic? And consciously integrating into the biblical worldview, whether that's using Scripture, quoting it directly, or ensuring that it's applied properly. There ought to be something that comes away that ethical foundation is transmitted via the speech, that moral thought has occurred in the process of giving this great speech. We also have our kids do things such as problem of evil speeches to defend their faith, and as an upper school principal, I sit in on every one of those our seniors give because I want to see that senior has thought through the primary objection to Christianity. If God is good, if God is all-powerful, then why is there evil? That the Christian God is either not all good or not all-powerful, or he'd get rid of evil. Defend why Christianity is right. And have the seniors process that. So I sit in. And when you can invite people to come in and to observe the speech in addition to the teachers, it adds a certain amount of that stress I was talking about, that pressure, to make it a little bit more important for them. And so you see the development over the period of time. To take something like the St. Crispin's Day speech, you band of brothers. You know, oh, I love that. But to have a 11th grader stand up in front of his classmates and be able to deliver it such that they literally clap at the end of it takes real practice, real effort. And in fact, this summer on the Grand Tour, they all asked one of their classmates to go and give it in the Theater of Epidaurus. And so the whole theater, there were German tourists there and British tourists and the Greeks, stood up and clapped at the end of the St. Crispin's Day speech that this young man gave. Because he gave it with passion. You really believed you were going to war that afternoon. It also helped that a thunderstorm was rolling in from the back, so the whole thing worked together. But the other thing we do is we take William Safire's very fine book, Lend Me Your Ears, which has the great speeches of history. And we give them a section of these speeches, whether it's Lincoln's inaugural, second inaugural address, John F. Kennedy's inaugural address, or Ronald Reagan's Tear Down That Wall. And then we have them memorize and do 5 to 7 minutes of a great speech from memory. That forces them to think about content and context. Content and context to own the material. And so that idea of kairos, who's your audience? How do I get it to resonate? What are the gestures I need to communicate something? They start thinking holistically about communication, which is fundamentally leadership. And then I want them to finally, when they go and sit in church, to be able to sit and listen to their pastor and be both encouraging and discerning. I as an elder, I am frustrated by the number of adults who come out of service. I didn't really get anything out of that. I didn't get fed. The pastor really didn't talk to me today. Nonsense. That was the word of God. It's your responsibility as somebody sitting in this church to be fed, to go and find what's good, true, and beautiful in this speech. The pastor has an impossible job. How does he keep the young kids involved? How does he keep the young moms with the young kids involved? How does he keep the elderly in your church involved? How does he keep those businessmen who have other thoughts in their mind involved? How does he keep your high school students involved? Teach your students how to be encouraging, to get something out of a speech, be looking to build up their classmates, to be looking to that pastor, I really appreciate what he taught me today about the Galatians. And then at the same time, be discerning. You know, if he had slowed down or used a better example, I might have gotten more out of it. So encouraging and discerning. We need humble advocates for the gospel who are willing to joyfully confess their sin and unapologetically speak the truth of Christ. That's the goal of great orders at a classical Christian school. Thank you.
Real quickly, anyone of us can speak to some of these. Someone asked to share some worthy examples of scientific or mathematic orators. Off the top of my head, some good communicators in that arena. You may find more written than spoken examples. Richard Feynman comes to mind. John Lennox comes to mind. There are some out there. Albert Einstein's speech on atomic proliferation is actually very good. Listening to it won't be very helpful because of his thick accent, but reading it and seeing what he brings to bear is pretty amazing. What's most important to be doing in 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th grades, etc., to create great orators by the 11th or 12th grade? And Ralph, perhaps you can speak to this too. A big part of that is populating the mind with copia, with words and ideas that will come to mind. There's a great example of that. We don't often see unrehearsed speeches anymore. When Bobby Kennedy was informed of the death of Martin Luther King Jr., the speech that he gave off the cuff was unbelievable. But in addition to that, I mean, he finished with with part of a poem that he had committed to memory, and it came to him at the right time. And that's what we want our students to be able to do when given an opportunity to speak on a subject, particularly when they don't have an opportunity to prepare, to have something to bring to the table, something more than just I don't know. would you add anything to that, Ralph? Things to do at the logic stage? Or
I think as you try to prove something in geometry or in logic, to be able to explain the tools you're using and the reasoning behind it is a wonderful rhetoric exercise that a dialectic student can get into. And so how do you explain a proof? How do you go through a mathematical problem or a science lab report? How do I explain, here are my variables, here's how I set the experiment up, here are my conclusions, here are the things, to have them be able to eloquently discuss their science experiment in front of the class is a terrifying experience, but forces them to be very analytical and organized in their thinking and their presentation, all wonderful dialectic skills. So I've encouraged the math and science people to get involved in having their students do presentations as a way of training great orators.
Of presentation and 20 minutes, followed by 20 minutes of
Someone suggested Stanley Jakey's. Did I say that right? Yaki, thank you. J-A-K-I, as a good source for communication and critique of scientific ideas. Question is, how do you help students cultivate a love for ideas? How do you help them to try not to mimic others' ideas, but be brave to form and develop their own ideas? That starts really early in helping students to see the ideas behind the stories they love. Our very young students reading Frog and Toad books, for example, if you're familiar with those. Getting beyond Frog and Toad and the words that are in that text to ask, what makes Frog and Toad friends? What does it mean to be you're guiding them toward the idea of friendship, the idea of friendship kind of love. And that's a theme you can take through to The Lord of the Rings when you ask about the friendship between Frodo and Sam, and to the ancient world when you ask about questions, connections, and friendships that are evident in myth and in story. But it begins with guiding them toward that, and then being open to the ideas that they bring to the table. If they bring something up, you may not like what they bring up, the idea that comes to them, but you've got to find a way to nurture that and guide them toward a better understanding of it. One of the best professors I ever had, I remember very clearly someone bringing up an idea in response to the reading that we had for that day, and he paused, and it was a stupid idea, but he paused and he said, "That's an interesting idea. Tell me a little bit more about that." And he gave them some time to talk, and then he just guided them toward a better, more biblical understanding. We were actually talking about the Gospel of John, of the idea that they had. So he was willing to drill down to the nugget that was good and help them to shuck the husk that was bad. So that's the biggest part of it, is being a guide and being open, I think. And you guys can add to that if you like.
Rhetoric one, we're focusing more on stylistic figures and general rhetorical.
I'll just add too that as far as the parental contribution, we ask that the students practice the speeches on their own, right? And then they naturally form like a safe place. So because they know what. The 12 students in this particular section all have each other's back, right? So they're practicing in the room, and they attend all their... we had 57 seniors this year, so they attended all of the seniors' theses, but they would get together and practice individually. But the parents could set up these nice dinners where they would say, student A, B, and C, why don't you go today? And so they would all get together at a particular house and practice that way. In terms of some of the more... just a couple of fun, practical things. My background, again, is more on the theoretical side. My colleague is more into the performative aspects of rhetoric. But she has these really cool things where these students, they would perform their speeches while somebody was ringing a bell or while students' phones were going off, or when we'd have someone that was designated to be to ask questions that were tangential, right? Or students that were asking questions that were distracting and somebody knocks a chair over. So getting students accustomed to having to push through the rigors of distraction, I think all of those are helpful. They do other fun things like having to talk with pencils in your mouth, and that's not really my thing, but it seems to be effective, so...
Awesome. Yeah.
Really? Yeah.
Good job.
Prince George's County.
Yeah.